Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Friday, March 22, 2013. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. The governor's oil tax reform bill narrowly passed the Senate on Wednesday. Although its trip through the House will likely be smoother, Sitka Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins continues to oppose it. The freshman Democrat has not changed his opinion on the administration's proposed oil tax reform since his campaign to win his seat last summer. KCAW's Robert Woolsey spoke with Christ Tompkins briefly following the Senate's vote about that issue and other high-profile matters for the district.
Jonathan Christ Tompkins has always considered lowering taxes on oil companies to be a bad idea, but after Wednesday's Senate vote, he's upped his rhetoric.
It's a tragedy.
Christ Tompkins watched the drama unfold from a seat in the Senate gallery for 10 hours as the Republican majority worked to retain the votes of its more moderate members while fending off amendments from minority Democrats. Christ Tompkins says it was important to him to listen to the debate in person.
Because it's the most significant vote in Alaska legislature in recent history. And it was a bad vote, and it's a bad bill, and it's bad policy, and it's bad for Alaska, and I'm very distressed by it.
Sitka's Senator Bert Stedman, a Republican, was among those who opposed SB 21. So did Southeast's other senator, Democrat Dennis Egan of Juneau, who caucuses with the Republican majority. The bill passed the Senate thanks in part to a compromise that restored $300 million in the base tax rate. The deal was a concession to Senator Click Bishop, a moderate Republican from Fairbanks, who cast the 11th and decisive vote. Christ Tompkins believes the bill will sail through the House. It's also likely that the industry-friendly resources and finance committees may reduce or eliminate some of the hard-fought concessions in the Senate. He considers this an opportunity.
Candidly, that's going to be the last opportunity to kill this bill, is when it goes back to the Senate for what's called concurrence, when the Senate has to agree with the revisions made by the House, which, and those revisions are in all likelihood going to be more friendly to the industry than the Senate bill is. And there may be some moderate senators who took a big swallow last night and voted for this oil tax cut who may not be able to swallow it when it comes back to them.
As a member of the minority, Christ Tompkins will not have much say in how oil tax reform looks after moving through the House, but he was more optimistic about his ability to influence some other legislation getting a second wind from the new Republican-led majorities.
School vouchers and voter ID, which are controversial bills, and if the Bush caucus holds strong on the voter ID bill and also on the school voucher bill, both of those bills are dead. They're just, as a consequence, just are not the votes in the House to pass either bill.
The Bush caucus was reorganized this year by representatives primarily from coastal communities. It has 12 votes in the 40-member House. Locally, Christ Tompkins is aware of the dramatic budget cuts being faced by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium because of federal sequestration. The $3.5 million reduction will mean the loss of programs and jobs throughout Southeast Alaska. Christ Tompkins did not think the legislature would take any emergency measures to intervene in those losses while Congress remained deadlocked.
The legislature is already cutting money for behavioral health, for tobacco cessation programs, and when we're already hemorrhaging money for programs that I believe are really important, I would just have to say it's probably unlikely that the state would take on any additional obligations.
Jonathan Christ Tompkins represents House District 34 in the Alaska Legislature. The session is scheduled to adjourn on April 14th. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Sitka will play host to a massive disaster drill in the next week. Operation Orca involves a scenario where radioactive and other dangerous materials are found on the Sitka shoreline. The exercise is being led by local emergency officials and the Army National Guard. It involves more than 150 participants from 40 agencies, including local firefighters, police, rescue personnel, and the Coast Guard. Assistant Fire Chief Al Stevens.
We have the Army National Guard coming in. Some from as far away as Guam and Hawaii. And this is an exercise that's very well controlled.
Stephen says members of the public might see an increase in activity around town in the next few days. A convoy of military equipment was expected to arrive by ferry Thursday. In addition to giving all the participants a chance to train, the event is providing important experience to local responders.
Saturday, we have a mass casualty drill for our EMT folks, because they're getting ready to wrap up their class. They're going to be providing decontamination training for both hospitals, and there's also going to be a lot of training that's involved outside of the whole exercise itself.
Stevens adds that local responders are already pretty good at dealing with some chemical spills and other hazardous material situations. If something bigger happens, he says it'll probably be local police and firefighters who deal with it before outside agencies with more experience respond. That's why Stevens says this exercise is important. Operation Orca will take place at points around Sitka, but away from largely public areas. Stevens says the normal flow of everyday life is not likely to be interrupted. Last night at the state 3A basketball tournament in Anchorage, the Mount Edgecombe Braves won handily over Valdez, 68-46. Edgecombe advances to play Anchorage Christian tonight at 8:45 p.m. Sitka High School's Lady Wolves, meanwhile, eked out a win against Valdez, 37-34. The Lady Wolves also take on ACS today at 5:15 p.m. Raven Radio will continue to update scores on air and online at kcaw.org. Ross Cohen was a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks for 10 years. He's also a research associate Museum of the North and first-year PhD student in history in Washington. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver spoke with Cohen about the Bristol Bay salmon crisis of 1937 when a Japanese fisherman illegally entered the fishery.
The time is July 7th, 1937. Tensions are brewing in Europe, and America is waiting to see if a Second World War will break out. The Japanese have invaded Manchuria, and war is beginning between China and Japan. Across the Pacific Ocean, Alaskans are wondering what will happen next.
Japanese imperialism was on the rise. That was very clear, and consequently, American fear and anxiety about exactly what was going to be happening in the Pacific and how Alaska might be drawn into that conflict was very much on Alaskan's mind.
That's Alaska historian Ross Cohen. He says at that time, another conflict is brewing in the waters of Bristol Bay. He says it's hard to know exactly how many vessels entered Alaskan waters that week, but it may have been as many as 30.
Now, this is about four or five large processing vessels, what they called floating canneries. These were ships that had processing and canning facilities right there on board the vessel. And then there were probably another couple dozen smaller trawlers that used gill nets to harvest the salmon, which were then transferred onto these motherships.
In the 1920s, fisheries off of Japan were declining, so the Japanese moved on to Kamchatka, a Soviet territory they had access to after the Russo-Japanese War of 1904. Those were in decline as well.
And so the Japanese moving into the eastern Bering Sea, coming into Alaska waters, was really a function of they had already overfished their home fisheries, and now they came into Alaska thinking that this was a fishery that they might find productive and economical.
At that time, the Fisheries Bureau prohibited the use of motorized vehicles, fish traps, and purse seines in Alaska. This was to ensure a 50% escapement of the spawning salmon to guarantee sustainability of the resource. This means the Alaskan fishermen were working on wooden vessels with only 900-foot maximum length gill nets.
But now you have these 10,000-ton steel Japanese vessels that are diesel-powered. They're operating gill nets 2, possibly even 3 miles in length. I mean, it was such a technological mismatch in favor of the Japanese that you're exactly right. It proved intimidating, and it really fed Alaskans' feelings of resentment.
Cohn says there had been a long-standing tension between resident Alaskan fishermen and the salmon canneries based in Seattle and San Francisco.
But yet when the Japanese enter Bristol Bay and threaten to, you know, extinguish the salmon fishery, all of a sudden you've got common cause between Alaskans and people in the lower 48. And it really aligned their interests in a way that hadn't quite happened before.
The United States came to an agreement with Japan that the Japanese would refrain from fishing in Alaskan waters. This agreement was honored until Japan and the United States entered World War II following the incident at Pearl Harbor. However, it came up once again more than a decade later. In 1953, the U.S., Canada, and Japan passed the North Pacific Fisheries Treaty, in which the region's resources were jointly managed by the three countries. This treaty is the model for international fisheries regulations today. Cohen says the Bristol Bay salmon crisis was the first time questions of international fishing boundaries really came to light.
I mean, for many, many years, Alaska fisheries were essentially secure simply by virtue of the fact that no other nation had the technological capability to enter the fishery and then economically harvest those fish. When the Japanese proved that it could be done in 1937, it was in many ways the start of these questions that we're still dealing with today.
He says that's just one of the many legacies of the 1937 Bristol Bay salmon crisis. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
An Alaska House panel is scheduled to discuss a bill that would require public school teachers to work a couple more years before they could acquire tenure rights. House Bill 162 by Representative Tammy Wilson says that teachers be employed in the same district continuously for five full school years or accept a teacher contract for six consecutive school years to be eligible for tenure. Under current law, teachers who work for three continuous years or accept a contract for four consecutive years can get tenure. In her sponsor statement, the North Pole Republican said her bill brings Alaska one step closer to ensuring high-performing quality teacher in every classroom. The House Education Committee, the bill's only committee of referral, is scheduled to take up the measure today. And that's all for Raven News. If you've missed any of our stories or would like to hear them again, please visit us online at kcaw.org. It's currently 27 degrees downtown in Sitka, and you are listening to Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka.